This is Audible.
Tantor Audio presents The Life We Bury by Alan Eskins. Narrated by Zach Via. Chapter 1. I remember being pestered by a sense of dread as I walked to my car that day, pressed down by a wave of foreboding that swirled around my head and broke against the evening in small ripples. There are people in this world who would call that kind of feeling a premonition, a warning from some internal third eye that can see around the curve of time. I've never been one to buy into such things, but I will confess that there have been times when I think back to that day and wonder if the fates had truly whispered in my ear, if I had known how that drive would change so many things. Would I have taken a safer path? Would I turn left where before I had turned right? Or would I still travel the path that led me to Carl Iverson? My Minnesota Twins were scheduled to play the Cleveland Indians that cool September evening in a game to crown the Central Division champion. Soon the lights of Target Field would flood the western horizon of Minneapolis, shooting up into the night like rays of glory, but I would not be there to see it. Just one more thing I couldn't afford on my college student budget. Instead, I would be working the door at Molly's Pub, stealing glances at the game on the television above the bar as I inspected driver's licenses and tamped down drunken arguments. Not my career of choice, but it paid the rent. Oddly enough, my high school guidance counselor never mentioned the word college in any of our meetings. Maybe she could smell the funk of hopelessness that clung to my secondhand clothing. Maybe she had heard that I started working at a dive bar called the Piedmont Club the day after I turned 18. Or, and this is where I place my bet, maybe she knew who my mother was and figured that no one can change the sound of an echo. Regardless, I didn't blame her for not seeing me as college material. Truth is, I felt more comfortable in the dinge of a bar than I did in the marbled halls of academia, where I stumbled along as though I wore my shoes on the wrong feet. I jumped into my car that day, a 20-year-old rusted Honda Accord, dropped it into gear and headed south from campus, merging with a stream of rush-hour traffic on I-35 and listening to Alicia Keys on blown Japanese speakers. As I hit the crosstown, I reached over to the passenger seat and fumbled through my backpack, eventually finding the piece of paper with the address of the old folks' home. "Don't call it an old folks' home," I mumbled to myself. "It's a retirement village or a senior center or something like that." I navigated the confusing streets of suburban Richfield, eventually finding the sign at the entrance to Hillview Manor, my destination. The name ceded to that place had to be some kind of a prank. It viewed no hills and lacked the slightest hint of grandeur suggested by the word manor. The view from the front was of a busy four-lane boulevard, and the back of the building faced the butt end of a rickety old apartment complex. The bad name, however, may have been the cheeriest thing about Hillview Manor, with its gray brick walls streaked green with moss, its raggedy shrubs run amok, and its mold, the color of oxidized copper, encasing the soft wood of every window sash. The place squatted on its foundation like a football tackle, and seemed equally formidable. As I stepped into the lobby, a wave of stale air, laden with the pungent aroma of antiseptic cream and urine, flicked at my nose, causing my eyes to water. An old woman wearing a crooked wig sat in a wheelchair, staring past me as if expecting some long-ago suitor to emerge from the parking lot and sweep her away. She smiled as I passed, but not at me. I didn't exist in her world, no more than the ghosts of her memory existed in mine. I paused before approaching the reception desk, listening one last time to those second thoughts that had been whispering in my ear, petulant thoughts that told me to drop that English class before it was too late and replace it with something more sensible like geology or history. A month earlier, I'd left my home in Austin, Minnesota, sneaking off like a boy running away to join a circus. No arguments with my mother, no chance for her to try and change my mind. I just packed a bag, told my younger brother that I was leaving, and left a note for my mom. By the time I made it to the registrar's office at the university, all the decent English classes had been filled, so I signed up for a biography class, one that would force me to interview a complete stranger. Deep down, I knew that the clammy sweat that pimpled my temples as I loitered in the lobby came from that homework assignment, an assignment I had avoided starting for far too long. I just knew the assignment was going to suck. The receptionist at Hillview, a square-faced woman with strong cheeks, tight hair, and deep-set eyes that gave her the appearance of a gulag matron, leaned over the countertop and asked, "Can I help you?" "Yes," I said. I hope so. "Is your manager here?"
"We don't allow solicitations," she said,
her face becoming brittle as she narrowed her focus on me. "Solicitations?" I gave her a forced chuckle and held out my hands in an imploring gesture. "Ma'am," I said, "I couldn't sell fire to a caveman."
"Well, you're not a resident here, and you're no visitor, and you sure don't work here, so what's left?"
"My name's Joe Talbert. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota."
"And?"
I glanced at her name tag.
"And, Janet, I'd like to talk to your manager about a project I have to do." "We don't have a manager," Janet said through her squint. "We have a director, Mrs. Larngren."
"I'm sorry," I said, trying to maintain my pleasant facade. "Can I talk to your director?"
"Mrs. Larngren's a very busy lady, and it's supper time."
"It'll only take a minute."
"Why don't you run your project by me, and I'll decide if it's worth disturbing Mrs. Larngren?"
"It's an assignment I'm doing for school," I said. "For my English class, I have to interview an old person. An elderly person, and write a biography about them. You know, tell about the struggles and forks in the road that made them who they are."
"You're a writer?"
Janet looked me up and down as if my appearance might answer that question. I straightened up to the full extent of my 5'10" height. I was 21 years old and had accepted that I was as tall as I was ever going to be. "Thank you, Joe Talbert Sr., wherever the hell you are." And while it was true that I worked as a bouncer, I wasn't the big meat you normally see at the door of a bar. In fact, as bouncers go, I was on the puny side. "No," I said, "not a writer, just a student."
"And they're making you write a whole book for school?"
"No, it's a mix of writing and outline," I said with a smile. "Some of the chapters have to be written out, like the beginning and the ending and any important turning points. But mostly it'll be a summary. It's a pretty big project." Janet wrinkled her pug nose and shook her head. Then, apparently persuaded that I had nothing to sell, she picked up the phone and spoke in a lowered voice. Soon, a woman in a green suit approached from a hallway beyond the reception desk and took up a position next to Janet.
"I'm Director Larngren," the woman announced,
her head held erect and steady as if she were balancing a teacup on it.
"Can I help you?"
"I hope so." I took a deep breath and ran through it all again. Mrs. Larngren chewed over my explanation with a puzzled look on her face and then said,
"Why did you come here? Don't you have a parent or grandparent you can interview?"
"I don't have any relatives nearby," I said. That was a lie. My mother and my brother lived 2 hours south of the Twin Cities, but even a brief visit to my mom's place could be like a walk through a thistle patch. I never met my father and had no idea if he still stained the earth. I knew his name, though. My mom came up with the brilliant idea of naming me after him, in the hope that it might guilt Joe Talbert Sr. into staying around a while, maybe marrying her and supporting her and little Joey Jr. It didn't work out. Mom tried the same thing when my younger brother, Jeremy, was born, but to the same end. I grew up having to explain that my mother's name was Kathy Nelson, my name was Joe Talbert, and my brother's name was Jeremy Naylor. As for my grandparents, the only one I ever met was my mom's father, my Grandpa Bill, a man I loved. He was a quiet man who could command attention with a simple glance or nod, a man who possessed equal parts strength and gentleness and wore them not in layers but blended like fine leather. There were days when I sought out his memory, when I needed his wisdom to deal with the tidal swells in my life. There were nights, however, when the sound of rain splashing against a window pane would seep into my subconscious, and he would visit me in my dreams. Dreams that would end with me bolting upright in my bed, my body covered in a cold sweat, and my hands trembling from the memory of watching him die.
"You do understand that this is a nursing home, don't you?"
Mrs. Larngren asked. "That's why I came here," I said. "You have people who've lived through amazing times."
That's true,
she said, leaning into the countertop that separated us. From up close, I could see the wrinkles that branched out from the corners of her eyes and creased her lips like a dry lake bed. And I could smell the faint aroma of scotch in the stream of her words as she spoke. She continued in a lowered voice.
Residents live here because they cannot take care of themselves. Most of them are suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia, or some other neurological condition. They can't remember their own children, much less the details of their lives.
I hadn't thought of that. I could see my plan starting to falter. How could I write the biography of a war hero if the hero can't remember what he did? Don't you have anybody with a memory? I asked, sounding more pitiful than I would have liked.
We could let him talk to Carl,
Janet piped up. Mrs. Lorngren shot Janet a glance akin to the glare you'd give a buddy who just screwed up your perfectly good lie. Carl? I asked. Mrs. Lorngren crossed her arms and stepped back from the counter. I pushed on. Who's Carl? Janet looked to Mrs. Lorngren for approval. When Mrs. Lorngren finally nodded, Janet took her turn leaning across the countertop.
His name is Carl Iverson. He's a convicted murderer, she said,
whispering like a schoolgirl telling a story out of turn.
The Department of Corrections sent him here about 3 months ago. They paroled him from Stillwater because he's dying of cancer.
Mrs. Lorngren huffed and said,
Apparently, pancreatic cancer is a perfectly reasonable substitute for penal rehabilitation.
He's a murderer? I asked. Janet glanced around to be sure that she wouldn't be overheard.
30 years ago, he raped and murdered this 14-year-old girl, she whispered. I read all about it in his file. After he was done killing her, he tried to hide the evidence by burning her body in his tool shed.
A rapist and a murderer. I had come to Hillview looking for a hero, and instead I'd found a villain. He would certainly have a story to tell, but was it a story I wanted to write? While my classmates would turn out tales of Grandma giving birth on a dirt floor, or Grandpa seeing John Dillinger in a hotel lobby, I would be writing about a man who raped and killed a girl and then burned her body in a shed. The idea of interviewing a murderer didn't sit well with me at first, but the more I thought about it, the more I warmed up to it. I had put off starting this project for too long. September was almost over, and I'd have to turn in my interview notes in a few weeks. The classmates had their horses out of the starting gate, and my nag was still back in the barn munching on hay. Carl Iverson would have to be my subject, if he agreed. I think I'd like to interview Mr. Iverson, I said.
The man is a monster, Mrs. Lorngren said. I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. I know this isn't a Christian thing to say, but it would be best if he just stayed in his room and passed on quietly.
Mrs. Lorngren recoiled at her own words, words a person might think but must never say out loud, especially in front of a stranger. Look, I said, if I can do his story, maybe I can get him to admit the error of his ways. I was a salesman after all, I thought to myself. Besides, he has a right to have visitors too, doesn't he? Mrs. Lorngren looked cornered. She had no choice. Carl wasn't a prisoner at Hillview. He was a resident with the same right to have visitors as anyone else. She unfolded her arms, placing her hands once more on the countertop between us.
I'll have to ask him if he wants a visitor, she said. In the few months that he's been here, he's only had one visitor come to see him.
Can I talk to Carl myself? I said. Maybe I can...
Mr. Iverson,
Mrs. Lorngren corrected me, eager to regain her superiority. Of course, I shrugged an apology. I could explain to Mr. Iverson what the assignment is about, and maybe... A jingling of electronic chimes from my cell phone interrupted me. I'm sorry, I said. I thought I shut it off. My ears turned red as I pulled my phone out of my pocket and saw my mother's number. Excuse me, I said, turning my back to Janet and Mrs. Lorngren with the pretense of acquiring privacy.
Mom, I can't talk right now. Joey, you gotta come get me.
My mother screeched into the phone, the drunken slur in her voice melding her words together, making them hard to understand.
Mom, I have to... They fucking handcuffed me.
What?
Who? They arrested me, Joey. They... Those pricks. I'm gonna sue them. I'll get the baddest fucking lawyer.
She yelled her words at someone near her.
You hear me, you prick? I want your badge number. I'll have your job.
Mom, where are you? I spoke loud and slow, trying to get my mother's attention back.
They put me in handcuffs, Joey.
Is there an officer there? I asked. Can I talk to him? She ignored my question and spiraled from one unintelligible thought to another.
If you loved me, you'd come get me. I'm your fucking mother, goddammit. The handcuffed... Get your ass... You never loved me. I did. I didn't... I should just cut my wrists. No one loves me. I was almost home. I'm gonna sue.
Okay, Mom, I said. I'll come get you, but I need to talk to the cop.
You mean Mr. Prick?
Yeah, Mom. Mr. Prick. I need to talk to Mr. Prick. Just give him the phone for a second, and I'll come get you.
Fine,
she said.
Here, Prick. Joey wants to talk to you.
Ms. Nelson, the officer said. This is your time to contact an attorney, not your son.
Hey, Officer Prick. Joey wants to talk to you.
The officer sighed. You said that you wanted to talk to an attorney. You need to use this time to call an attorney.
Officer Prick won't talk to you.
Mom belched into the phone. Mom, tell him I said please.
Joey, you got it.
Damn it, Mom. I yelled my whisper.
Tell him I said please.
A moment of silence, and then...
Fine.
My mom turned the phone away so that I could barely hear her.
Joey says please.
There was a long pause, but then the officer got on the phone. Hello. I spoke quickly and quietly. Officer, I'm sorry about all this, but I have a brother who's autistic. He lives with my mom. I need to know if my mom's getting released today, because if she's not, I gotta go take care of my brother. Well, here's the deal. Your mother's been arrested for DUI. I could hear my mother cursing and wailing in the background. I have her at the Mower County Law Enforcement Center to give a breath test. She invoked her right to call an attorney before taking the test, so she's supposed to be using this time to contact an attorney, not calling you to come get her out. I understand, I said. I just need to know if she's getting released tonight. That would be no. The officer limited his response in a way that my mother would not hear what was in store for her. I played along. Is she going to detox?
Yes.
How many days?
Between 2 and 3.
Then she'll be released? I asked.
No.
I thought for a moment.
From detox to jail?
That is correct, until she makes her first appearance in court.
Mom heard the word court and began to yell again. In her inebriation and exhaustion, her words swung and lurched like a decrepit rope bridge.
Damn it, Joey. Get down here. You don't love me? You ungrateful? I'm your mother. Joey, they get down here. Get me out.
Thanks, I said to the officer. I really appreciate the help, and good luck dealing with my mom.
Good luck to you too, he said.
I ended the call and turned back around to see Janet and Mrs. Lorngren looking at me like I was a toddler who had just learned that dogs can bite. I'm sorry about that, I said. My mother, she's not well. I'm not going to be able to meet Carl, Mr. Iverson, today. I have to take care of something. Mrs. Lorngren's eyes softened, her stern expression dissolving into sympathy.
That's fine, she said. I'll talk to Mr. Iverson about you. Leave your name and number with Janet, and I'll let you know if he is agreeable to meet with you.
I really appreciate that, I said. I wrote my information on a piece of paper. I might have my phone turned off for a while, so if I don't answer, just leave a message and let me know what Mr. Iverson says.
I will,
Mrs. Lohengrin said. A block away from Hillview, I pulled into a parking lot, gripped the steering wheel with all my strength, and shook it violently.
God damn it,
I yelled.
Damn it, damn it, damn it! Why can't you just leave me alone?
My knuckles turned white, and I trembled as the wave of anger passed through me. I took a deep breath and waited for the throbbing in my throat to subside, for my eyes to clear. Then once I had calmed down, I called Molly to let her know that I wouldn't be able to work the door. She wasn't happy, but she understood. After I hung up, I tossed the phone on the passenger seat and began the long drive south to get my brother. Chapter 2 Most people had never heard of Austin, Minnesota, and those that have heard of it know it because of Spam, a salted pork product that never rots and feeds soldiers and refugees all over the world. It's the crown jewel of Hormel Foods Corporation and the nicknamesake of my hometown, Spamtown. They even have a museum in Austin devoted to the greatness of Spam, and if that didn't stamp Austin with the equivalent of a prison tattoo, there was the strike. It happened 4 years before I was born, but kids growing up in Austin learn about the strike the way some children learn about Lewis and Clark, or the Declaration of Independence. A recession in the early 1980s had taken a chunk out of the meatpacking industry, so Hormel asked the union to take a big pay cut. Of course, that went over like a kick to the nuts, and the strike began. Pushing and shoving on the picket line led to riots. The violence attracted the networks, and one television crew clocked out by crashing a helicopter into a cornfield up near Ellendale. The governor finally sent in the National Guard, but by then the violence and animosity had left a mark on the town that some would say gave it character. I just saw it as an ugly scar. Like any town, Austin had its good points, too, although most people don't see the skin beside the pimples. It had parks, a pool, a decent hospital, a Carmelite monastery, its own municipal airport, and it was only a hop away from the famous Mayo Clinic in Rochester. It had a community college where I had been taking classes while at the same time working two part-time jobs. In 3 years, I had saved up enough money and racked up enough credits to allow me to transfer to the U of M as a junior. Austin also had 13 bars, not counting hotel bars and service clubs, and with a population of 23,000, give or take, Austin had one of the highest bar-to-citizen ratios in Greater Minnesota. I knew the bars well, having been in every one of them at one point or another. I stepped in my first bar when I was a mere nub of a kid, probably no more than 10 years old. My mother left me at home to keep an eye on Jeremy while she went out for a drink or two. Being 2 years older than my brother and him being autistic, making him such a quiet kid and all, Mom felt that I was plenty old enough to babysit. That night, Jeremy sat in an armchair in the living room watching his favorite video, The Lion King. I had geography homework to do, so I locked myself in the tiny bedroom he and I shared. I don't remember most of the rooms we shared over the years, but I remember that one. Walls as thin as crackers, painted the same bright blue that coats the bottom of every public swimming pool in the world. You could hear the slightest sound from one room to the next, including the songs of The Lion King, which Jeremy played over and over and over. I sat atop our bunk bed, a second-hand piece of crap with springs so useless that our mattresses had to rest on sheets of plywood, covering my ears to try and block out the noise. But it did little to muffle the incessant, repetitive music kicking through the porous walls of my concentration. I'm not sure if this next part is true or an embellishment of my memory born of guilt, but I asked Jeremy to turn down the volume, and I swear he turned it up instead. A guy can only take so much. I stomped into the living room and pushed Jeremy out of his chair, causing him to fall hard against the wall. The impact knocked loose a picture above his head, a picture of me holding him when I was 3 and he was a baby. The picture popped off of its nail, fell down the wall, and crashed into the top of Jeremy's blonde head, the glass shattering into 100 spikes. After Jeremy brushed the debris off of his arms and legs, he looked at me. A wedge of glass stuck out of the top of his head like an oversized coin jammed in an undersized piggy bank slot. His eyes narrowed, not in anger, but in confusion. Jeremy rarely looked me in the eye, but that day he stared at me like he was on the verge of solving some great riddle. Then, abruptly, as if he'd found his answer, His eyes softened, and his gaze shifted to the blood drops accumulating on his arm. I grabbed a towel from the bathroom, carefully removed the glass from his head, which hadn't penetrated as deep as I had feared, and wrapped the towel around him like a turban. I used a washcloth to wipe the blood off his arm and waited for the bleeding to stop. After 10 minutes, blood still trickled from the cut, and the white towel had become blotched with large, bright red patches. I rewrapped the towel around Jeremy's head, put his hand on the end of the towel to hold it in place, and ran out the door to find our mother. Mom didn't need to leave a trail of breadcrumbs for me to find her. Our car sat in the driveway of the duplex with 2 flat tires, which meant that Mom had to be within walking distance. This limited my options to a couple bars. It didn't strike me as odd, at the time, that my mother left me alone to look after an autistic brother, and never bothered to mention where she was going, or that I automatically knew to look for her in the bars. Then again, a lot of what I considered normal in my childhood appears so completely messed up when I look back now. I found her on my first try, at the Odyssey Bar. The emptiness of the place caught me by surprise. I'd always envisioned my mother stalking off to join an army of beautiful people who joked, laughed, and danced like they did on the TV commercials. But this place had bad country music crackling through cheap speakers, uneven floors, and reeked of feckless mediocrity. I saw my mother right away, chatting with the bartender. At first I couldn't tell if the look on her face showed anger or concern. But she answered that question by grabbing my arm with a blood-cutting grip and dragging me out of the bar. We walked at a brisk pace back to the apartment and found Jeremy watching his movie, his hand still on the towel where I'd left it. When Mom saw the bloody towel, she lost a hinge.
"What in the hell did you do? Jesus Christ, look at this mess!"
She pulled the towel off his head and lifted Jeremy off the floor by his arm, dragging him into the bathroom and lifting him into the empty bathtub. Blood matted his fine blonde hair. She threw the bloody towel into the sink and went to the living room to scrub 3 tiny spots of blood from the rust-brown carpeting.
"You had to use my good towel," she yelled. "You couldn't just grab a rag. Look at this blood in the carpet. We could lose our damage deposit. Did you ever stop to think about that? No, you never think. You just make the goddamn mess and I have to clean it up."
I went into the bathroom, half to get away from my mother and half to be with Jeremy in case he got scared. He didn't get scared, though. He never got scared. Or if he did, he never showed it. He looked at me with a face that, to the rest of the world, would appear expressionless, but I could see the shadow of my betrayal behind his eyes. No matter how much I've tried to put that night behind me, to bury it someplace deep inside and let it die, the memory of Jeremy looking up at me continues to breathe. Jeremy was 18 now, old enough to stay alone in the apartment for a few hours, but not for a few days. As I pulled into the driveway of Mom's apartment that night, the twins and the Indians were all tied up at 1 run apiece in the 3rd inning. I let myself in with the spare key and found Jeremy watching Pirates of the Caribbean, his new favorite movie. He looked surprised for only a second. Then he looked at the floor between us. "Hey, buddy," I said. "How's my little bro?" "Hello, Joe," he said. When Jeremy started middle school, the district assigned him a teaching assistant named Helen Bollinger. She knew about autism, understood Jeremy's need for patterns and routines, his preference for solitude, his aversion to touching or being touched, and his inability to understand much beyond primal needs and black-and-white instruction. While Mrs. Bollinger struggled to bring Jeremy out of his darkness, my mother encouraged him to be seen and not heard. That wrestling match went on for 7 years, with Mrs. Bollinger winning more than she lost. By the time he graduated from high school, I had a brother who could carry on something akin to a conversation, even if he had to struggle to look at me when we talked. "Maybe I thought you were at the college," Jeremy said, speaking in a strict staccato cadence, as if he were placing each word in careful order upon a conveyor belt. "I came back to see you," I said. "Oh, okay." Jeremy turned back to watch his movie. "Mom called me," I said. "She's got a meeting, and she's not going to be home for a while." It was easy to lie to Jeremy, his trusting temperament being incapable of understanding deceit. I didn't lie to him to be mean. It was just my way of explaining things to him without the complexity or nuance that came with the truth. The first time that my mother found her way to detox, I came up with the lie that she was at a meeting. After that, I told Jeremy that Mom had a meeting every time she ran off to one of the Indian casinos or flopped at some guy's house for the night. Jeremy never asked about the meeting, never wondered why some meetings lasted a few hours and others lasted a few days, never wondered why these meetings happened so suddenly. "This meeting is one of those long meetings," I said. "So you get to stay with me for a few days." Jeremy stopped watching TV and began looking around the floor, a thin furrow forming above his eyebrows. I could tell that he was building up to make eye contact with me, a task that did not come naturally to him.
"Maybe I will stay here and wait for Mom," he said.
"You can't stay here. I have to go to my classes tomorrow. I gotta take you with me, to my apartment." My answer wasn't what he wanted to hear. I could tell because he stopped trying to look me in the eye, a clue that his anxiety was on the rise.
"Maybe you can stay here and go to your classes in the morning?"
"My classes are at the college. That's a couple hours away from here. I can't stay here, buddy." I remained calm, but firm.
"Maybe I will stay here by myself."
"You can't stay here, Jeremy. Mom told me to come get you. You can stay at my apartment at college." Jeremy began to rub his left thumb across the knuckles of his right hand. He did this when his world made the least sense.
"Maybe I can wait here."
I sat on the couch next to Jeremy.
"This'll be fun," I said. "It'll just be you and me. I'll bring the DVD player, and you can watch any movie you want. You can pack a whole bag of nothing but movies."
Jeremy smiled.
"But Mom's not going to be back for a few days, and I need you to come to my apartment. Okay?"
Jeremy thought hard for a bit, then said,
"Maybe I can bring Pirates of the Caribbean?"
"Sure," I said. "It'll be fun. We'll make it an adventure. You can be Captain Jack Sparrow, and I'll be Will Turner. What do you say?"
Jeremy looked up at me and did his favorite imitation of Captain Jack, saying, "This is the day you'll always remember as the day you almost caught Captain Jack Sparrow."
Then Jeremy laughed until his cheeks turned red, and I laughed with him, the way that I always laughed when Jeremy cracked a joke. I grabbed some garbage bags and gave one of them to Jeremy to fill with DVDs and clothes, making sure that he packed enough to last a while just in case Mom didn't make bail. As I pulled out of the driveway, I contemplated my work and class schedules, trying to find gaps that would allow me to keep an eye on Jeremy. On top of that, distracting questions tripped through my brain. How would Jeremy get along in the unfamiliar world of my apartment? Where would I find the time or the money to bail my mother out of jail? And how the hell did I become the parent in this wreck of a family? Chapter 3. On the drive back to the Twin Cities, I watched the anxiety pace back and forth behind my brother's eyes, his brow and forehead creasing and relaxing as he processed what was happening. As the miles fell behind my tires, Jeremy grew more comfortable with our adventure until finally he relaxed with a deep exhale, the way I've seen dogs sigh in that moment when vigilance surrenders to sleep. Jeremy, the boy who laid his head on the bottom level of our bunk bed and shared my room, my closet, and my dresser drawers for 18 years, was with me again. We had never been apart for more than a night or two in all our lives until a month ago, when I moved to campus, leaving him behind with a woman who swam in chaos. As far back as I could remember, my mom had been prone to wild mood swings, laughing and dancing across the living room one minute, throwing dishes around the kitchen the next. Classic bipolar, from what I understand. Of course, that diagnosis was never made official because my mother refused to get professional help. Instead, she lived her life with her fingers in her ears, as though the truth would not exist if she never heard the words spoken aloud. Add to that cauldron an ever-increasing measure of cheap vodka, a form of self-medication that quelled the inner scream but amplified the outer crazy, and you get a picture of the mother I left behind. She hadn't always been that bad, though. In the early years, my mother's moods used to have a ceiling and a floor that kept the neighbors and child protective services out of our lives. We even had some good times. I can remember the three of us going to the Science Museum, the Renaissance Festival, and the Valley Fair Amusement Park. I can remember her helping me with my math homework when I struggled to multiply double digits. I could sometimes find a crack in the wall that had grown between us and remember her laughing with us and even loving us. When I tried, I could remember a mother who could be warm and soft on those days when the world stayed off her back. That all changed the day my Grandpa Bill died. A feral restlessness descended upon our little trio that day, as though his death severed the one tether that gave my mother stability. After his death, she let go of what little restraint she possessed and simply floated on the wave of her moods. She cried more, yelled more, and lashed out whenever the world overwhelmed her. She seemed determined to find the darker edges of her life and embrace them as some kind of new normal. Hitting was her first rule change. It started gradually, but eventually she took to slapping me across the face whenever her tea kettle brain started to boil. As I got older and less sensitive to the slaps, she adjusted her aim to hit me in the ear. I hated that. Sometimes she would use implements like wooden spoons or wire fly swatter handles to make her point. Once, in seventh grade, I had to miss a wrestling tournament because the welts on my thighs were visible around my wrestling uniform and she forced me to stay home. For years, she left Jeremy out of our battles, preferring to take all of her frustrations out on me. But as time went by, she began to lose control with him, too, yelling and cursing at him. Then, one day, she went too far. When I was 18 and out of high school, I came home to find my mother particularly drunk and angry and hitting Jeremy in the head with a tennis shoe. I dragged her into her bedroom and threw her down on the bed. She got up and tried to hit me. I grabbed her wrists, spun her around, and tossed her back onto the bed. She tried twice more to come at me and ended each attempt face down on her mattress. After the last attempt, she paused to catch her breath and ended up passing out. The next morning, she acted like nothing had happened, like she had no memory of her craziness, like our little family unit wasn't on the brink of its inevitable collapse. I played along, but I knew. I knew that she had reached a point where she could justify hitting Jeremy. I also knew that once I left for college, it would likely get worse. Those thoughts made my chest hurt. And so, just as my mother pretended nothing was wrong after her blackout, I buried my thoughts deep inside, hiding them where they would remain undusted. But as we headed to my apartment that night, life was good. Jeremy and I listened to the Twins game as we drove. At least, I listened to it. Jeremy heard the game, but couldn't follow it from one minute to the next. I chatted with him, explaining things about the game as we drove, but he would rarely respond. When he did, he stepped into the conversation as if he had just come in from another room. By the time we pulled off I-35 up near campus, the Twins were laying a walloping on Cleveland, having scored 4 runs in the bottom of the 8th to take a 6-4 lead. I whooped at each run scored, and Jeremy whooped in imitation of me, laughing at my excitement. When we arrived, I led Jeremy up the steps to my apartment on the 2nd floor, his garbage bags in hand. We bounded through the door just in time to turn on the TV and watch the Twins throw the final out to win the game. I held my hand up to high-five Jeremy, but he was turning a slow circle, taking in the smallness of my apartment. The kitchen and living room were at opposite sides of a single space. The bedroom was barely bigger than the twin bed it contained, and my apartment had no bathroom, at least not within the confines of its walls. I watched as Jeremy scanned the apartment, his eyes covering the same territory over and over again, as though the next pass might expose a hidden bathroom door. "Maybe I need to go to the bathroom," Jeremy said. "Come on," I said, motioning to Jeremy. "I'll show you." My bathroom was across the hall from my front door. The old house had originally been built in the 1920s to hold one of those large, turn-of-the-century families that gave birth at a pace to outrun infant mortality rates. It had been subdivided in the 1970s, with a 3-bedroom apartment on the main level and 2 single-bedroom apartments upstairs, with only one of the upstairs units big enough to have its own bathroom. So, at the top of the steep, narrow stairway, the door to the right was my apartment, the door to the left was my bathroom, and the door straight ahead was the other 2nd-floor apartment. I dug Jeremy's toothbrush and flavored toothpaste out of one of the garbage bags and headed across the hall to the bathroom, with Jeremy following at a cautious distance. "This is the bathroom," I said. "If you need to go, just lock the door." I showed him how to flip the deadbolt. He didn't walk into the bathroom. Instead, he examined it from the relative safety of the hallway. "Maybe we should go back home," he said. "We can't, buddy. Mom's at her meeting, remember?" Maybe she is home now.
She's not home now. She's not going to be home for a couple days.
Maybe we should call her and see.
Jeremy began rubbing his thumbs across his knuckles again. I could see a slight tremor growing out of his anxiety. I wanted to put my hand on his shoulder to try to settle him down, but that would only exacerbate his reaction. And Jeremy's autism was like that. Jeremy turned toward the steps, contemplating their steep pitch, pressing his thumb even harder to the back of his hand, kneading the knuckles like bread dough. I moved to block Jeremy from the steps. He was taller than me by 2 inches and outweighed me by a good 20 pounds. About the time he turned 14, he surpassed me in height, weight, and looks. His golden hair curled around his head with a Nordic swirl, where my dirty blonde hair stuck out like straw if I didn't tame it with a touch of hair gel. His jaw was square, with a boyish dimple on the tip, where my chin was forgettable. His eyes sparkled ocean blue when he smiled, where my eyes were the hazel of weak coffee. Despite having every physical advantage over me, he remained my little brother, and therefore susceptible to my influence. I stood a step below him, my hands on my biceps, easing him back, trying to turn his attention away from the stairs and back toward my apartment. Behind me, at the bottom of the steps, I heard the door to the foyer open and close, followed by the cadence of feminine footsteps. I recognized the sound of her footfall, having listened to her pass by my door every day now for the past month. I knew her only as L. Nash, the name on the piece of tape that crossed her letterbox. She stood all of 5'2", with short, black hair that whipped around her face like water dancing off rocks. She had dark eyes, a pixie nose, and a chilly penchant for being left alone. She and I had passed each other many times in the hall or on the steps. When I tried to engage her in small talk, she smiled politely, responded appropriately, but never stopped, always doing her best to pass by my interruption without seeming rude. She paused halfway up the stairs to watch me holding Jeremy by the arms, physically preventing him from leaving. Jeremy saw L. Nash and stopped moving, dropping his eyes to the floor. I stepped to the side to let her go by, the walls of the stairway squeezing together as she passed, the scent of her body wash and baby powder brushing my nose. "Hi," I said. "Hi," she returned, raising an eyebrow in our direction and walking the remaining few paces to her apartment door. I wanted to say something more, so I blurted out the first stupid thought that jumped into my head. "It's not what it looks like," I said. "We're brothers." "Yeah," she said, as she turned the key in her lock. "I'm sure that line worked for Jeffrey Dahmer, too." She stepped into her apartment and closed the door. Her quip left me dumb. I wanted to shoot back my own clever retort, but my mind had seized up like a rusty bolt. Jeremy didn't watch L. Nash like I did. He stood quietly at the top of the stairs, no longer rubbing his thumb to his knuckle. His emergency had passed. The stubbornness in his eyes had been replaced by fatigue, it being well past his normal bedtime. I guided him into the bathroom to brush his teeth, and then to the bedroom, where I rolled my old television in so that he could watch his movie on the DVD player. Then I grabbed a blanket and settled onto the couch. I could hear Jeremy watching his movie, the familiar dialogue and music lulling him to sleep, distracting him from the insecurities of this new environment. Despite the drama at the top of the steps, I had to admire Jeremy for adapting as well as he did. Even small changes in his routine, like a new toothbrush or the wrong breakfast cereal, could knock him off kilter. But here he was in an apartment he had never seen before, an apartment half the size of the one he called home, an apartment that didn't even have its own bathroom, falling asleep for the first time in a bed that didn't have a top bunk. I turned off my phone earlier in the evening to avoid the barrage of calls I expected from my mother. But now I pulled it out of my pocket, turned it on, and checked my missed calls. There were 21 calls from a number in the 507 area code, no doubt my mother calling from the detox center. I could just hear her screaming at me for shutting off my phone and for leaving her in detox and jail, even though I had no part in that decision. The first 9 voice messages were from my mother.
"Joey, I can't believe you treat your own mother like this."
Delete.
"Joey, I don't know what I did to deserve..."
Delete.
"Well, now I know that I can't count on you."
Delete.
"I know I'm a terrible mother."
Delete.
"Joey, if you don't answer your phone, I'll..."
Delete.
You don't love me.
Delete.
I'm sorry, Joey. I just wish I was dead. Maybe then...
Delete.
You think you're some hot shit college...
Delete.
Answer your fucking phone.
Delete.
Joe, this is Mary Lorngren from Hillview Manor. I just wanted to call and tell you that I spoke to Mr. Iverson about your project, and he has agreed to meet with you to discuss it. He wanted me to make it clear that he is not agreeing to do it, mind you. He wants to meet with you first. You can call Janet tomorrow to find out when is a good time to come by. We don't like to disturb the guests during their mealtimes. So just call Janet. Bye-bye.
I turned off my phone and closed my eyes, a slight smile creasing into my cheeks, absorbing the strange irony that I might soon be interviewing a savage murderer, a man who gave no thought to ending a young girl's life. A criminal who survived more than 30 years in the worst hellhole prison in Minnesota. Yet I did not dread that conversation nearly as much as I dreaded seeing my own mother again. Still, I could feel a wind at my back, one that I chose to see as favorable, one that I hoped would bring me a good grade in my English class. With my sails filled, I might be able to overcome my procrastination in starting the assignment. It never occurred to me as I nestled on my couch that such a wind might also be destructive. When I finally fell asleep that night, I did so wrapped comfortably in the belief that my meeting with Carl Iverson would have no downside, that our encounter would somehow make my life better, easier. In hindsight, I was at best naive. Chapter 4. Carl Iverson wasn't wearing shoes when they arrested him. I know this because I found a picture of him, barefoot, being led past the remains of a burned-down shed toward a waiting squad car. His hands were cuffed behind his back, his shoulders slumped forward, a plain-clothed detective holding one of his biceps and a uniformed officer holding the other. Iverson wore a simple white t-shirt and blue jeans. His dark, wavy hair was pressed into the side of his head, as if the cops had just pulled him out of bed. I found this picture in the bowels of the University of Minnesota's Wilson Library, in a glass-walled archive where thousands of newspapers are stored on microfilm, some dating back to the days of the American Revolution. Unlike the rest of the library, where shelves were filled with stories of the heroic and the famous, the archive room held newspaper articles written by guys with pencils behind their ears and ulcers in their stomachs, articles written about everyday folk, the quiet people. They could never have dreamt that their stories would survive for decades, even centuries, to be read by a guy like me. The archive room had the feel of a tabernacle, with millions of souls packed away on microfilm like incense in tiny jars, waiting for someone to free their essence to be felt, tasted, inhaled again, if only for a moment. I began with a search for Carl Iverson's name on the internet. I came up with thousands of hits, but one site had an excerpt from some legal document that referred to an appellate court decision regarding his case. I didn't understand all of the legal jargon, but it gave me a date when the murder took place. October 29th, 1980. And it gave me the initials of the murdered girl. C.M.H. That would be enough information to find the story in the newspaper. I moved from task to task quickly, pressed into efficiency by my brother's unexpected presence in my life, and more than a little flustered at having one more ball to juggle. I found myself thinking about Jeremy and wondering how he was managing back at the apartment. I wondered if my mom's bail hearing would happen by Friday. I had to work at Molly's on Friday, and didn't want to go to work and leave Jeremy alone. I needed to get him back to Austin before the weekend. Molly would almost surely fire me if I had to miss work again. I'd woken Jeremy that morning before I left for school, poured him some cereal, pulled the TV back into the living room, and showed him again how to use the remote. Jeremy was 18 years old, so it's not that he couldn't pour his own cereal, yet the unfamiliarity of my apartment would likely have befuddled him. He would go hungry rather than open a strange cupboard door to look for food. I considered skipping my classes that day, but I had already lost too much time procrastinating. I laid out some of Jeremy's favorite DVDs and told him that I would be back in a couple hours. I hoped that he would be okay being alone for that short time, but my concern was growing with every passing minute. I went into the microfilm stacks, found the reel for the Minneapolis Tribune for October 29th, 1980, slid it into the reader, and scanned the front page for the story. It was not there. I moved to the following pages and still found no mention of a murder, at least not one that involved a 14-year-old girl or the initial CMH. I read the entire newspaper and came up blank. I leaned back in my chair, ran a hand through my hair. I was starting to think that the date in the court opinion was wrong. Then it dawned on me. The story would not have made the paper until the next day. I rolled the spool forward to the next day's edition. The top story for October 30th, 1980, was a half-page article about a peace treaty between Honduras and El Salvador. Beneath that, I found the story I was looking for. A story about a girl murdered and burned in northeast Minneapolis. The article ran down a sidebar beside a picture of a fire. The picture showed firefighters shooting water on what appeared to be a shed about the size of a single-car garage. The flame shot skyward a good 15 feet above the roof, suggesting the photographer had snapped the picture as firefighters were just beginning their efforts to extinguish the flames. The article read, "Human remains found in Pierce Street blaze. Minneapolis police are investigating after charred human remains were discovered yesterday in the debris of a burned tool shed in the Wyndham Park neighborhood of northeast Minneapolis. Firefighters responding at 4:18 p.m. to reports of a fire in the 1900 block of Pierce Street, northeast, arrived to find the tool shed engulfed in flames. Police evacuated neighboring houses while firefighters battled the blaze. Fire Marshal John Vries reports that investigators combing through the debris discovered a charred body amid the rubble. The body has not yet been identified. Police have not ruled out foul play." The article went on for a few more paragraphs with unimportant details about the estimated damage and the reaction of neighbors. I printed a copy of the page and then spooled through the microfilm to the next day's edition. In a follow-up article, the police confirmed that the body found the day before had been identified as 14-year-old Crystal Marie Hagen. The body had been badly burned, and authorities suspected that she had already been dead when the fire was set. The burned-out shed was located next door to the house where Crystal had lived with her mother, Danielle Hagen. Her stepfather, Douglas Lockwood, and her stepbrother, Dan Lockwood. Crystal's mother, Danielle, told reporters that they had noticed that Crystal was missing shortly after word spread that a body had been discovered in the debris of the shed. Crystal was positively identified as the deceased using dental records. The article ended with the note that 32-year-old Carl Iverson had been taken into custody for questioning. Iverson lived next door to Crystal Hagen and owned the shed where Hagen's body was found. Next to the article, I found the photograph of the two officers arresting a barefooted Carl Iverson. Using the knobs in the microfilm reader, I enlarged the picture. The two cops wore coats and gloves in contrast to Iverson's t-shirt and jeans. The uniformed officer had his gaze set on something behind the photographer. From the hint of sadness in his eyes, I speculated that he might have been looking at Crystal Hagen's family as they watched the arrest of the monster that killed and burned their daughter. The plainclothed cop had his mouth open, his jaw slightly crooked, as if he were saying something, maybe even yelling something at Carl Iverson. Of the three men in the photo, only Carl Iverson looked at the camera. I didn't know what I was expecting to see in his face. How do you hold yourself after committing a murder? Do you strut as you walk past the charcoal-black aftermath of the shed where you burned her body? Do you wear a mask of nonchalance and pass by the ruins with no more interest than if you were walking to the corner store for some milk? Or do you flip out with fear, knowing you've been caught, knowing that you've breathed your last measure of freedom and will spend the rest of your life in a cage? When I zoomed in on Carl Iverson's face, on his eyes, as he looked at the photographer, I saw no pride, no false calm, and no fear. What I saw was confusion. Chapter 5. There is an odor that permeates old apartment buildings. When I was a kid, I noticed its effect on the people who came by to visit my mother's apartment. That split second of corruption as the taint of decay hits them square in the face, the twitch of the nose, the flutter of blinking, the reining in of the chin. When I was little, that mustiness was what I thought all homes smelled like. Not scented candles or fresh baked bread, but dirty sneakers and unwashed dishes. By the time I was in junior high, I found myself looking away in embarrassment any time someone came to the door. I swore that when I grew up and got my own apartment, I would get one that smelled of old wood, not old cats. As it turned out, that was not easy to do on my budget. The triplex apartment building I lived in had an ancient cellar that breathed dankness up through the floorboards, filling the structure with a pungency born of wet dirt mixed with the tang of rotting lumber. The odor was strongest immediately inside the common front door, where our litter boxes were bolted to the wall. Within that foyer, the steps to my apartment rose to the right, and to the left, a door led to the main floor apartment where a Greek family, the Costas, lived. Sometimes the aroma of rich cooking spices seeped through that door, mixing with the cellar funk to overwhelm the senses. I made a point of keeping my apartment clean, vacuuming weekly, washing dishes after every meal. I'd even dusted once in the short time that I had lived there. I wasn't a clean freak by any stretch. I simply refused to let my apartment succumb to its natural state of entropy. I went so far as to plug an air freshener into an electric socket that pumped out spurts of apple and cinnamon to welcome me home every day. But what caught my attention that day, as I walked through my door, wasn't the pleasantry of the artificial air freshener. It was Jeremy sitting on my couch beside the girl I knew only as Elle Nash, and they were giggling. "Now that's what you call ironic," Elle Nash said. "Now that's what you call ironic," Jeremy repeated. Then he and Elle Nash broke into another laugh. I recognized the line from Jeremy's Pirates of the Caribbean movie. It was another one of Jeremy's favorite lines. They were watching the movie together. Jeremy was sitting, as he usually does, in the center of the couch, directly in front of the TV, his feet flat on the floor, his back straight against the curve of the couch back, his hands balled up on his lap where he could fidget with them if needed. Elle Nash sat in the corner of the sofa, her legs crossed over one another, wearing jeans and a blue sweater. Her dark eyes flitted weightlessly as she laughed with Jeremy. I'd never seen her smile before, at least not beyond the cursory upturn at the edges of her lips as we passed each other in the hallway. But now, her smile transformed her, as if she had grown taller or changed her hair color or something. Her cheeks popped with dimples. Her lips seemed redder and softer against the backdrop of her white teeth. Damn, she was cute. Jeremy and Elle Nash looked up at me as if I were a parent intruding upon a slumber party. "Hello?" I said, my tone betraying my confusion. What I wanted to say was, "Jeremy, how the hell did you get Elle Nash into my apartment and sitting on my couch?" Elle Nash must have seen the confusion on my face because she offered an explanation. "Jeremy was having a little problem with the TV," she said, "so I came over to help." "Problem with the TV?" I said. "Maybe the TV did not work right," Jeremy said, his face shifting back to his normal flat effect. "Jeremy hit the wrong button," Elle Nash said. "He pushed the input button by mistake."
"Maybe I just pushed the wrong button," Jeremy said. "I'm sorry, buddy," I said. I had made that mistake a few times myself, accidentally switching the internal input from DVD to VCR, causing the TV to explode with a noisy white static, which had to be a personal hell for Jeremy. "So how did he... I mean, who..."
"Maybe Lila fixed it," Jeremy said.
"Lila," I said, letting the name rest on the tip of my tongue for a bit. So that's what the L stood for.
"I'm Joe, and you've obviously met my brother Jeremy."
"Yeah," Lila said. "Jeremy and I are good friends already." Jeremy had turned his attention back to his movie, paying no more mind to Lila than he did the wall behind him. Like the idiot I was, a condition often exacerbated by the presence of a female, I decided that my next move would be to rescue Lila from Jeremy, to show her a seat at the adult table, impress her with my wit and charm, and sweep her off her feet. At least, that was my plan. "Are you surprised that I'm not a serial killer?" I said. "Serial killer?" Lila looked up at me, confused.
"Last night, you called me Jeffrey Dahmer."
"Oh, I forgot." She smiled a half-smile, and I scrambled to find a new topic of conversation, having missed the mark with my attempt at humor.
"So, what do you do when you're not fixing televisions?"
"I'm a student at the U."
Her words slid slowly from her mouth to punctuate that she knew damn well that I knew she was a student. We had passed each other on the stairs many times with textbooks in our hands. Yet, as lame as my overture had been, I had to view it as progress because we were having our first real conversation.
I often timed my entrances and exits from the building to coincide with hers, at least to the point where it didn't come across as creepy, and I could no more get her to talk to me than I could mix sunlight with shade. But there we were, having a conversation, all because Jeremy hit the wrong button. "Thanks for helping him out," I said. "I really appreciate it."
"Just being neighborly," she said, and started to stand up. She was going to leave. I didn't want her to leave.
"Let me show you my appreciation," I said. "Maybe I could take you out to dinner or something?"
My words fell heavy to the ground as soon as they left my mouth.
Lila curled one of her hands into the other, shrugged her shoulders, and said, "That's okay."
Her geniality faded like a toy succumbing to a dead battery, her eyes no longer weightless, her dimples gone. It was as though my words cast a pall over her.
"I should get going," she said.
"You can't leave," she started for the door.
"I mean, you shouldn't leave," I said, sounding needier than I intended. "Duty requires that I return the good deed."
I moved toward the door, half blocking her path.
"You should at least stay for lunch."
"I have to get to class," she said, skirting past me, her shoulder brushing lightly against my arm as she went by. Then she paused at the door, or at least I think she paused. Maybe she was reconsidering my invitation. Maybe she was toying with me. Or maybe, probably, my imagination was playing a trick on me and she didn't pause at all. I, of course, chose to err on the side of recklessness and press on.
"Let me at least walk you home," I said.
"It's 8 feet away."
"More like 10 feet," I said, following her into the hallway and closing my door behind me. I wasn't getting anywhere with my feeble banter, so I changed tactics and tried sincerity.
"I really appreciate what you did for Jeremy," I said. "He can be a bit, I don't know, childlike.
You see, he's autistic," she said.
"Yeah, I know.
I have a cousin on the spectrum. He's a lot like Jeremy."
Lila leaned against her door, her hand turning the knob.
"Why don't you join us both for dinner tonight?" I said, shredding any semblance of subtlety.
"Just my way of saying thanks. I'm making spaghetti." She stepped inside her apartment and turned to meet my eyes, her face suddenly serious.
"Listen, Joe," she said, "you seem like a nice guy and all, but I'm not looking for a dinner. Not right now. I'm not looking for anything right now. I just want to..."
No, I understand," I interrupted her.
"I thought I'd ask. It's not for me, it's for Jeremy," I lied.
"He's not good at being away from home, and he seemed to like you."
"Really?" Lila smiled. "You're going to pimp your brother out like that just so you can cook me a meal?"
"Just being neighborly," I smiled back.
She started to close the door, but hesitated as she turned the idea over in her head a couple times.
"Okay," she said. "One dinner, that's all. For Jeremy."